Welcome to Okay, Let's Talk. I'm your host, Kendall Ford. I am a writer, storyteller, and absolutely love empowering people. I believe that our stories and experiences, no matter how much pain or heartbreak they may have once caused, hold incredible power. The power to bring freedom, the power to uplift others, and the power to live triumphantly. Sometimes people just need a listening ear and a safe space. This is that space. So, okay, let's talk. Oh my goodness. Welcome, everyone. So happy to have you here with me today. It has been a couple weeks since our last episode, and if you follow me on social media, you know that my daughter and I are in the process of moving, and so that has been a whole nother situation, but it required me to kind of take a couple weeks off and collect myself, but I'm super excited to be back here with you guys today. I've been planning and writing stuff down and all that, so I have a lot to talk about, and we'll just keep going over the next few weeks. But yeah, my family's in a season of transition, and yeah, if you follow me on social media, you know, or if you listen to the show regularly, you know that we've been living in Missouri, and I liked it in Missouri, but to be honest, there was a few things that I was struggling with there, and one of them is just the lack of diversity. And Cam started to struggle a little bit in school. And when I can handle a lot, but I don't play when it comes to my daughter. So I really needed Cam to be back with her village, to be in a really positive Black environment. And so in order to do that, we decided to move back home. And I also got a new job, and our stuff is still in Missouri. We're working on getting that out here to Maryland now. But yeah, that's why you haven't heard from me in a couple weeks. But I hope your Christmas season is off to an amazing start. I have a really good 5-minute soapbox that I want to talk with you guys about. And it's something that I have been thinking about a lot. I can't even remember where I saw that or heard this. But there's just one little question that I've heard, and I believe I got it from a creator off of TikTok, because y'all know I love TikTok, but it really just has had me thinking, and it's had me processing my personal decisions, my life decisions, my professional decisions. And so I'm gonna go ahead and start the timer, because y'all know I may use less time, but I try not to go over the 5-minute mark when it comes to my 5-minute soapbox. So yeah, I just started the timer. And so what I want to talk to you guys about in this 5 minutes is, it's just one question. And that question is, what type of ancestor will you be? And like I said, I heard this question on TikTok, and it kind of just, it's like hit me upside the head, and it's just stuck with me. And when I think of my life choices that I'm making, the plans that I have, the things I want to do, when I look at it in that light of what kind of ancestor will I be, it makes me want to be bold. It makes me want to go after all my hopes and dreams. It makes me want to work hard to leave a legacy for my family, something that I feel like has been lacking a lot recently in the Black community. And so today, as you are going about your day, and as you're driving and you're working or you're dreaming, take a moment to ask yourself, like, what kind of ancestor will you be? Currently, will you be the kind of ancestor that kind of just like ceases to exist and then life just kind of moves on? Or will you be the kind of ancestor where people can pinpoint your presence in the family? They can point back to things that you have left them. And not just talking like financially, but like property or creative pieces or just your perspective, right? And for me, that idea of like, what kind of ancestor will I be, really makes me want to be the type of writer I've always dreamt of being. Writing is my biggest form of creative expression. And when I think about the type of ancestor I want to be, I would love to leave works of art, pieces of my writing, where my family that comes after me can say, can know me still, you know, that they can have a little bit of guidance from me, that they can see that I was a real person, that I had real struggles, that I loved deeply, that I tried hard, that I was a dreamer, that I lived my life. And that's the kind of legacy I want to leave for my family. I would love to also, you know, leave money, property, things like that. But I think above all else, I want to leave pieces of myself so that they can know what they're made of, so that they can know the kind of grit that comes in our family, the kind of love that comes from our family, the kind of dreamer spirit, and especially from the women in our family, there comes a lot of spunk. We don't take a lot of shit. And we also don't take no very well. We're like, what do you mean you don't want me to do something? Well, I'm gonna do it anyway. And I especially want the women in my family to who come after me to know and experience that. So yeah, that's all I have for you guys today in this 5-minute soapbox. And I just really want you to take some time today or this week or even this month, or I mean, we're coming to the end of the year and approaching the beginning of a new year, so it's a great time to reflect and just think, what kind of legacy am I leaving? Is that important to me? And if I can purposefully be in control of my legacy, what is it that I want my family to know about me, to know about life, to know about things I've learned and experienced? Yeah, so what kind of ancestor are you going to be? All right, everybody. So today I'm really excited about this topic that we're going to talk about, and especially about my guest. So the baby boomer and millennial relationship, I feel like gets a lot of shit. Like there's a lot of memes that make fun of the, you know, each generation. And in the workplace especially, there's a lot of sometimes tension between baby boomers and millennials, and I get it. It can be hard growing older, and it's hard being younger because you think you know everything, blah, blah, blah. But there's also a lot of good that can come from those relationships. There's a lot that we can pull from one another, and especially when it comes to the whole conversation around race and race relations and things that are happening currently in our country. And so I decided to bring my mom onto the show, Patricia Ford. Welcome, Mom.
Well, thank you. I'm excited about being here.
I wanted to bring my mom on because she has a really interesting perspective being a baby boomer, but also she her kids are millennials, but she's also was in the work world for a very long time. She worked for the federal government for 40 years and didn't just work for federal government, but she was like the mom, you know what HIB means? No, HBIC. You know what HBIC means?
No.
It means head bitch in charge.
Oh my gosh. I hope you're not describing me like that.
That's what you were.
Well, in a way.
You were the HBIC for FDIC.
Really, kind of a layer of it.
Anyway, my mom has a lot of experience, just in dealing with the whole race thing. And so, without further ado, welcome to Okay, Let's Talk.
Okay.
Oh,
So where should we begin?
so mom, what is like? So tell me a little bit about your job and what was kind of like, not necessarily the nitty-gritty, because I know it was like banking and all that, but like as a black woman who came into that job as a college student, like what did you experience starting off? And then like had you seen things change since when you retired 40 years later?
Yeah, it was interesting. Think about that. When I started, it was a couple of dynamics that were happening in that banking world. Women in general were new coming in,
Right,
and
right.
then black people, another nuance. So it's a whole mixture. So for me, when a woman and black,└ And it was also not just in my workplace for who I work for, but also I had to go into banks. So I had a double whammy. I dealt with it at
work. You had your office work office, culture and then the banking culture. So where did you do, were your banks like in urban environments or were they all over the U.S.?
All over, but my primary area was like Maryland, Pennsylvania, Delaware. But back in the day, back then, it was, there were a lot of like private clubs associated with bankers and they were, white men. And I remember some guys going out to lunch and the women weren't allowed because it was an all men's club. So it was like those kind of different situations.
Right.
And then I remember going to the Eastern Shore of Maryland and the bankers didn't want to deal with me. They wanted to deal with the young white man working with me. And he had to say, she's in charge. You're going to have to talk to her. So then they had to figure out, well, who is she? And why, why is she here?
Right.
Where'd you go to school?
And just to clarify, this was like in the 1970s, right?
Right. I started with them in 79.
Right. So, yeah, so it was almost the 80s. So people always talk about, like, racism.
Yeah, I take it back. I did a two-year term before I went full-time. I delayed graduation for a year. So I actually started with them, I think, like, 76, 77, around that time period.
Okay. I also want to take this moment to say that I'm very jealous of the fact that my parents are the generation that, like, my mom stayed in the same job from her internship in college. You know how many jobs I've had since college?
I know. Yeah.
I'm jealous.
Right. But my siblings say that's insane, too.
Yeah, that's true.
That's not a norm. But it's interesting. I tried to leave many times, actually. But I just felt like there were roadblocks, and the Lord just didn't want me to leave for whatever reason. And quite frankly, at the end of the day, I was glad I hadn't. I did over 40 years there, and I really liked my job.
Yeah.
Despite, the normal hurdles and everything.
Right, but
I think I would have had those anywhere.
Yeah, that's true. So when you were first starting out and it was in the 80s and all that, do you remember any experiences that were just 100% it was a racist thing?
Oh,
like,
yeah. I remember actually being a trainee in somewhere in Pennsylvania, and it was a training group because we had training groups. And the person there was a leader who's an experienced person and those of us who weren't. So there was somebody who was doing a practice job. They were going to be in charge. It was a white man. And somehow people were leaving the job. We were finishing up. And it was just going to be me and him in this little town, like on a Friday or something like that. Something weird. We were all finishing up. And he complained to the guy in charge that he didn't want to be in the town with me. And I didn't want to be there with him either, so it was equal. But the guy, I give it to the guy who was training us, and he said to me, he said, look, if you're going to stay here, you're going to have to deal with all kind of people, all colors.
He said this to the guy.
He said it to me.
Oh, to you. Yeah. Oh, okay.
Because he was telling me, look, you just have to figure out a way to work this out. I'm not pulling you. I'm not pulling him. He's going to have to figure out. But this is what you're going to have to get used to. So basically, he was telling me, you're in it. So either you want to be in this and you can deal with it or not, because that's the way of the world.
Right, right.
I'm going to run into people like him all over. And actually, it turned out to be pretty well.
Did you ever feel, as you were out traveling to be in different towns and visit banks, did you ever feel not safe physically because of the color of your skin or because of your gender?
No, I can only remember one time feeling a little uncomfortable. I don't know why it sticks out in my mind. I was in Lexington Park, Maryland, and I was with my white coworkers because most of them were white and they're white men. And there were black people, guys throwing slurs about me being with these white men walking down the street. That's the only time I think I really felt like, yeah, this is kind of weird. Hopefully nothing pops off about all of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then fast forward, years later, grew in status in FDIC, and eventually you were hiring people. Right. And so tell me what it was like to be like a manager and then have hiring power as a black woman.
It was wonderful.
In the government.
Wonderful, because I was able to really be instrumental in having diversity and giving people of color opportunities.
Yeah.
And actually, my my coworkers who were other supervisors around in my region, they really were receptive to the whole thing, and they actually helped me train people, and because mm-hmm. I was doing a lot of hiring at some time. So it really, I mean, I really felt proud that I could do, you know, so much hiring yeah. and give people opportunities.
And especially, I remember you, like, being younger when I was, like, middle and high school. I remember when I would act up and you would be like, I'm trying to give all these Black people opportunities and you out here acting a fool. And I mean, now that I'm older, I kind of look yeah. back on that and I'm like, that's cool that yeah. you, like, speak a little bit about, like, the opportunities you would try to give Black yeah. folks in the banking world. I try to do that.
I think the hardest part was trying to talk to students both on college campuses and just, like, at church or different, and not all, you know, the banking environment is not for everybody. It is conservative.
Yeah, it's super boring, too.
Very conservative. But I remember trying to, your dad had a friend whose son was looking for a job. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to him. He came in to my office, and I would talk to him about, you know, application process.
Right, interview. Right.
And I said to him, I said, and by the way, you look very nice, but don't wear sneakers, wear a dress shoe. Mm-hmm. So he apparently went back and told his dad, and his dad was ticked off and told his wife, like, what the heck? Why is she talking about his shoes? Because look, that's how he presents himself.
Right.
That's part of the package.
Right, right.
How you look.
Right.
So I encountered some of that. And I also wanted to, you know, I'm of a different philosophy of GPA and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
that was
yeah.
an ongoing kind of battle for me because my agency, as many federal agencies, want to have the best of the best, and so they want to have this high GPA. But quite frankly, I wanted average people. You could have like a 2.5 as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
Because those are the people who are going to work the hardest,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened was all those high achievers, well, they're high achievers. They didn't stay. So mm-hmm. we spent all these hours and money of training, and they all
filled it out. Yeah.
You just need some everyday people who love their job and going to work hard.
Yeah, and grateful for the opportunity.
And grateful for the opportunity.
Yeah. So when you left, I know we talk about this a lot, but it wasn't, when you left FDIC and left the government and you retired and all that, it wasn't as diverse as you would have liked.
Yeah, it was, I would say the saddest part about, you know, like I loved my job, I loved all my coworkers and everything, but the sad part about it is the atmosphere of diversity had changed.
Yeah.
And so it was beginning to look like when I first got hired.
That's sad.
So, you know, the Black people there weren't really getting the promotions. It was
right.
mostly white women getting promotions. So that was probably the saddest thing, that the diversity was leaving. But it was in the Trump time, so.
Right.
You know.
Do you think that the lack of diversity that was there when you were leaving, would you say, because I know it's both and, like, I know a lot of things are at work,
mm-hmm.
but would you say that it was more so because the younger millennial Black, like, minorities that you would love to hire just weren't interested in government work? Or was it that the climate had changed so much that even the ones that were there weren't getting hired and it just wasn't our time right now?
Well, I think it was kind of multiple things going on. The ones that had been there that I hired, they wanted promotions, of course, and they wanted
yeah.
to move on to other things. So a lot of people I hired really did well and moved up in the corporation.
Yeah.
The hiring still did hiring, but I don't know. It just seemed to be more of a struggle about getting, like, for instance, I always found it hard to find Black males on the college campus
right.
when we went to recruit.
Right.
I mean, they just weren't there
and
in the business realm.
Statistically, they're the ones that aren't attending college
right.
anyway.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah.
So that was hard.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of dynamics there. But even my coworkers who were senior weren't really getting weren't getting the promotion.
Right. That's interesting. So then let's shift a little bit away from your work perspective, because
mm-hmm.
I'm curious to hear, like, from someone who has been around for a while, and you were alive when Martin Luther King was around, or at least towards the end of his life, and now it's 2021, in a lot of ways we're still dealing with the same crap. What does that look like? Because I know for me, as a millennial, it's super frustrating, but a lot of it, it's not new, but it's new to me. Like, I'm fresh in the fight, it feels
mm-hmm.
like. But for people that are your age, y'all ain't fresh in the fight. Like, what is this, all this stuff you see happening with, like,
police violence and Trump and all that stuff. Like, what does that make you feel like as a baby, as a black baby boomer?
Like, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Yeah.
Because when I was coming up back and during the Martin Luther King time, I mean, black people seemed more cohesive. We were doing more. And even in my neighborhood in Baltimore, we owned dry cleaners and stores and things. We were more involved in our community. And then somehow that dissipated. I mean, there was a change. And I'm not sure what happened with that in my age bracket, but we all went off. We had opportunities. We went to work for the government and just got all these good jobs. Right. We had all these opportunities. And then we wanted more opportunities for our children.
Right.
But somehow that just dissipated. And that comment of the more things change, the more they stay the same, you know, racism just... has changed on how it looks, you know, and how it, so you don't always recognize it, that it's there, but it's there. I mean, I had people who I worked with who didn't necessarily want to work for a black woman, but, you know, you go with the flow. But when Trump came, you know, there were people dancing a jig, I'm sure.
Right. You know? And you experienced that at work where people were like, you were like, and they might probably be a racist. And then Trump came in office. And you were like, oh, nope, there it is.
Yeah. And that's because that, I mean, it's real. I mean, it just changes and morphs into something different. And Trump, when he came to me, he just made it okay for people to come out with it.
Exactly.
Just be whoever you, say whatever you want to say, even if it's a lie, you know, just be out with him. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And so I think he got a lot of votes because I think that was the white people's savior of taking everything back.
Exactly. Yeah. When they were saying make America great again, I was like, do you mean white again? I wanted to be like, what part of history do you mean great?
Right.
Because, I mean, our history ain't really all that in a bag of chips.
No.
I'm trying. I still don't understand like what point in time they're talking about great.
I wasn't sure what that meant either.
I thought they meant slavery times, and I was like, oh. Right. That's not going to work for me.
But, you know, I feel like everything happens for a reason. And I believe that the Lord always reigns and he gives us the leaders that we want. So everybody want him.
Lord.
Yeah. You know, including all those people in the religious sector. They wanted him. So they got him.
Right.
And I'm sure a lot were disappointed later. They didn't get what they thought they were getting.
Right. So what is your opinion on like the way that white nationalism is so attached to the evangelical community in this country?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just really still...
And was it the same way when you were younger? Like, were people, like, calling people the N-word or saying, like, oh, you can't use this water fountain in the name of Jesus? Because I feel like that's...
You know, I never experienced that, though.
Yeah.
I never experienced that on a really... Because first of all, I went to black churches.
True.
And I did not deal in the white sector. I only did that when I got older.
Yeah.
But I do know my mother... My mother always let me know. She never really came out and said it, but she never liked really dealing with white people like that in any format that she didn't have to. And I'm sure it was probably because of what she grew up with.
Mm-hmm. And I think she probably knew, too, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Right. But in that church, see, that's only a nuance. I would say in the last few years, I'm learning about the white evangelical church.
Yeah.
And how they, you know, I always knew, I remember looking at that. What was that? It was a series about a little girl, and she was, I don't know, in the country somewhere. I can't remember. Anne with an E.
Oh, Annie with an E. It's about Anne of Green Gables.
Right. Yeah. And there was an episode in there where the religious people were there at a church, and they were locking the Indians up and taking their children and calling them heathens and all that. In the name of the Lord. And
that's
no.
Yeah.
So that's what happened long ago. That's what happened with them and black people. And then I found out recently that that's what they do when they go to other countries of color, that they really still look down on them. And I think their attitude is, I'm your savior. I mean, I know Christ. You don't. You can't know him, but I'm going to teach you what you need to know and how to worship. And that's nowhere in the scriptures about treating people like that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I love that show, by the way.
Yeah. That, to me, depicted that whole thing. And they felt like they were in their rights, stealing these people's children and locking them up and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. That was crazy. Mm-hmm. So that they could make them not be heathens.
And that's still how, like, white nationalists think in their, especially in the evangelical world. I feel like it's almost more dangerous because they're like, oh, so, okay, for example, so when Cam and I were living in Missouri, let me back up. So, like, the whole Kyle Rittenhouse thing with him, like, defending himself and all that in the trial in Wisconsin. Yeah, Kenosha, mm-hmm. Wisconsin. That was a little scary for me, and it was probably definitely one of the things that was like, oh, I need to get out of the Midwest, because he felt like he had this right as a white man to just go and defend his property or whatever he thought he was, his life or whatever. And I've seen that in Missouri when we were living there, where, like, I would be walking Jimmy any time of the day. The police would follow me on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. Regular old citizens would follow me and be like, well, what are you doing in this neighborhood? Mm-hmm. You could just feel that.
Mm-hmm. And that used to happen in this neighborhood when we first moved
here. Yeah, it did. But when we first moved here, it was like every now and then.
Yeah.
But in Missouri, it was like every day.
Yeah.
I was like,
right,
this is exhausting. And I had a point with that, and it's disappearing.
That's all right. It'll come back to you.
It'll come back to you. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, but that whole thing, that's just a new experience for me. I mean, it was shocking to see it for myself. And it was just something I never expected.
Yeah.
That just came out of the clear blue sky. Like, I was like, Lord, where did that come from?
Right. Oh, I remember what I was going to say. It was because, like, that whole, like, oh, they feel like they can protect their city. Like, they can protect Springfield. Even though I'm just walking my dog and minding their business, mm-hmm. minding my business. But to them, they're self-righteous. They are so, the culture still in a lot of parts of the Midwest is so tightly attached still to Christianity, mm-hmm. that they are racist and practice their privilege and everything in the name of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And it's so baffling to me. And because of that, it's in the name of Jesus, it's this self-righteousness that I almost feel like is much more dangerous than if people were just like, look, I'm a racist.
Right, but you know, people have always, I remember listening to Tony Evans, he made a comment one time, I was listening to one of his sermons, and he says, you know, people treat the Bible like a smorgasbord.
Yeah.
They treat the word of God like a smorgasbord. Oh, I'll take this piece and that piece. Oh, no, yeah. I don't like that one. This one works for me. This works for what I want.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happens. You know, you take which works for you to justify what you want to do and leave the rest.
Yeah.
But that's not really how that's meant to be.
And, you know, and that's how Christians voted Trump into office as well.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, okay, do you remember, Mom, we were in Kenya. And you and Dad had come to visit me and Cam in Kenya, and we went to lunch with some leaders.
So
we went to lunch with these leaders who were big in the whole East Africa region for Assemblies of God. And I mean, they're nice people. I think they meant well, but I think they didn't know their audience, and they were really ignorant. And so my parents are sitting there, and we're all Black, sitting there having lunch. And somehow the wife starts talking about how amazing Trump has been. And he's just so great for the Christians. And, and he's saving so many babies because of abortion. And we were like, oh. And I look at my mom and I was like, my dad is pretty good at keeping his cool. But I looked at you, Mom, and I was like, oh, she about to cuss this lady out.
No,
I was really proud of you.
Because I've seen many people like that. I mean, some people just don't know what to say. And quite frankly, I'm at a point in my life where, you know, if you haven't, sometimes it's hard for people to sympathize or understand if they haven't experienced anything.
Mm-hmm.
So we should never expect white people to understand where we're coming from, what we've been through, how we feel, because they haven't lived that.
Yeah.
And it's not our job to teach them that. They have to be on their own to figure all that out.
Yeah.
You know, I think was that Sandra Bullock who adopted my kids?
Mm-hmm.
She was talking about that on TV just recently, how she took it upon herself. She had to figure this out. She had to learn more about, if she's going to adopt Black children, she needs to know about their culture.
Exactly.
You have to take that on yourself and learn about that stuff.
Yeah.
And they're not going to feel as deeply as us because they don't have the scars. We have the scars.
Yeah, and we live with it every single day.
We have the scars. But the thing about it is we hope that those scars will make us stronger and not weaker. Because quite frankly, in my workplace, I always prayed every day, and I felt like the Lord made my scars stronger.
Yeah.
I remember one particular scenario where I was up for a promotion, and my supervisor, I don't know if it was a racial thing or not, had said she wasn't going to give it to me, and her boss didn't like me, and he was talking about me for whatever reason, white man, in meetings. And I was like, oh, you know, I can't control all that stuff. I'm not going to, and I just said, Lord, I can't, you know, whatever, I can't handle that. Mm-hmm. Next thing I know, the white man got mad with the white woman, and in front of her told me I was getting a promotion just to spite her. And I said, see, now that's how the Lord works. He will make your enemy give you your promotion and hurt the other person. And it was all about him hurting her, and it had nothing to do with me. Not that he wanted me to have a promotion, but see how that worked out.
Exactly.
My mm-hmm. So we just have to be strong and do our work. And my thing was, I worked for many different types of white men, and I remember some of my coworkers saying, why are you so nice to him? And why do you treat these people? I said, because my job is to come and do my job to the best of my ability.
Right.
And I'm always going to do my job. Now, what everybody else does, that's not on me.
Exactly.
What's on me is that I'm supposed to do and respect my boss and do that. You may act a fool, but I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do at work.
Exactly.
And to me, that made my path stronger because, quite frankly, a lot of those people who I felt like my enemies, at the end of the day, we got along very well. I mean, they got to know me. They really got a chance to know who I was.
Right, right. So I'm curious, because I've talked about this before on the show, lately the police violence that's been happening in the Black community, and not that it hasn't been happening, but it's really just getting recorded now, and so we're seeing it on social media, and people think, oh, this new thing is happening. Like, no, it's always been happening. It's just getting documented.
Right.
With, like, Trayvon Martin and Philando Castile and all these other Black people who have been killed by police violence, I felt like, for me, George Floyd was, like, the nail in the coffin that kind of just made me, mm-hmm. like, it made me shut down in a very special way that it was just, like, I can't take it anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was just my perspective as a young millennial in my 30s, trying to start out in life.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you to watch George Floyd in that situation for someone who's in their 60s and older and in a different generation?
Like, very sad and unbelievable that here we are now.
Yeah.
And you got these white men who feel like we are worthless.
Yeah.
Still. I mean, that hasn't changed. It just has not changed.
Yeah.
I don't know if that, you know, it just made me think, I don't know if that will ever change, because when you have people who feel like they are superior.
Yeah.
You know, they pass it down to their children, and it's a, and quite frankly, some of it's human nature. If you just look at kids, you know, kids don't really think a lot of times of the racial thing. They learn that.
Yeah.
But then as you get older, you gravitate toward people that look like you and do things. So they gravitate to their people. We gravitate to our people because you have more in common. So that kind of fosters that divide. And I don't know how that would ever change, because you would have to be colorblind.
Exactly. Change. Yeah.
And I don't see that in my lifetime.
Yeah.
The only way that color change, color blindness will take effect is way, 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 way down the road, where we become such blended races. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what white supremacists are worried about. They do not want the blending of the races, because then all people kind of look tan. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. too much blending.
Yeah.
So then you become kind of colorblind.
And I think I kind of believe that in a way too, because it was part of the reason that Cam and I made the move back to Baltimore recently. And it was just that in all that I've experienced in my 31 years of being on the earth so far, one of the biggest things I have learned is that I genuinely don't, like, having allies and advocates are great and we need them, but no one will lift up your people like your people.
Mm-hmm.
And so having white people who are learning about Black culture and learning about their own white privilege and white supremacy and all of that is amazing, but they got a lot to learn. And we've been learning about white folks all our lives. Like,
right. But then unfortunately you have the Black sector who doesn't do that, who don't do that. You know, I mean, unfortunately, the white Black people that want to be white, kind of like that movie we watched, Passing.
Oh gosh.
And there are people like that. Look, even in my own family, there were, you know, some marriages between people like fair skin, dark skin, and that was a whole racial thing. Yeah, because
the light skin, dark skin thing is still a real thing. That's real,
and it's real actually in, I think, other societies too. But what happens is that you have, you know, I saw black people in the white workplace that were like, it's all about me. They're not really about helping. Not everybody is. Even if you're black, everybody's not about helping somebody.
Right. Else. Everybody's not going to be bridge builders or be vocal right. or all that.
Right. But my thing is that that's, you know, I felt like that was my calling. If the Lord put me in a position, I want to hire people and help people of color, young people, you know, get good jobs and all that.
Right.
You know, to have opportunities like I had.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of how I feel too, is that I have left Baltimore and learned and experienced a lot. And in that, I've grown to love my people, black people, even more. And I've just seen that we need to empower ourselves a little more. Mm-hmm. And young black folks need to see middle-aged, older, whatever, black folks living their best life.
Because we learn from each other, actually. I mean, I hired millennials, and I think it's not even a race thing. As you get older, particularly in your career, sometimes you don't want to train people, you don't want to deal with their nuances and all that. But I always welcome that, because you learn new stuff. Yeah. And quite frankly, they could do a whole bunch of stuff I couldn't do, and I needed that.
Yeah.
So I take advantage of people's skills, whatever they are.
Yeah. You know? So what is it like for you? Like, what is your opinion on, what is your opinion on millennials, especially black millennials, mm-hmm. being the mother of millennials?
Meaning.
Like, what, like, do you love us? Do you, like, have mixed feelings about us? Are you frustrated with some of our mindsets? Or are you just like, it's cool?
No, I'm not frustrated at all. And I think that, you know, there's a cycle of life. So as we go through all these things that you talked about, you know, there has to be people coming behind me. Like, in my generation, you know, there were people who protested and all that, but then I had it easier because of those people.
Then
things became harder for you all behind me for a lot of dynamics. But there always has to be an uprising, is what
That's
I want to say.
That's
At
good.
Some point in a number of years, black folks, to get what they want, got to have an uprising of some kind.
Mm-hmm.
So the millennials and behind them, they're going to, you know, the attitude has to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be different than my attitude.
Right.
You know, and I dealt with things differently. I mean, we didn't have social media and all that stuff. And, you know, my thing was having a strategy of dealing with people just in life. Know who you're dealing with and dealing with them accordingly.
Right.
You know, whereas now, if you guys look at things and look at people differently, and you don't take a lot of stuff that we probably took.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, I mean, I've seen black people degraded, humiliated, and all that in the workplace.
Yeah, and one thing about millennials, we will leave a job.
Yeah, right,
and,
exactly.
And you think we will leave a job the generation after us?
Right.
Oh, they will leave a job and give you no notice.
Exactly.
They just won't show up the next day.
Exactly.
Okay, so as we close, I have two big questions. One is, what would you say to, especially to other black baby boomers, like, what would you say to them who are annoyed with black millennials, frustrated with us, or... for whatever reason, maybe they feel pushed out of the workforce. Maybe they feel like we're too loud. Maybe they feel like we're too technology based. Like, what would you say to people in your age bracket about, like, how to handle and deal with millennials?
I would say embrace the differences.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I've been trained too much in federal government. You know, you get all this training about
getting
along with people communication. But I always feel like, you know, when in my working group, I had a lot of staff. I don't need clones of me.
Exactly.
I need other people. Great leaders want all these different minds and all these different people, because quite frankly, you're going to make me look good and do the work better.
That's true.
So I'm going to embrace whatever you bring to the table.
Yeah.
You know, so I say embrace those differences, because usually you can find a positive out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And then one last question. What would you say to empower and inspire young Black millennials who are getting cynical and developing hard hearts, which I'll be honest, I feel like, mm-hmm. especially in the last 4 years, just some of the crap that Cam and I have been through, mm-hmm. it's been hard for me to not be cynical. I've had to really do a lot of hard work and go to therapy. Praise the Lord for therapists. Mm-hmm. So that I don't want to become what other people are putting onto me. I don't want to become full of hate because people have showed hate and indifference to me. So what would you say to us who are still in the fight and we're young, starting still kind of in the beginning of our mm-hmm. careers, and we're trying to navigate all this without, yeah. and we're watching Black people still get right. gunned down?
I would say it's no different than when I was young, just starting.
Yeah.
That I faced a lot of obstacles. And other Black people, I remember telling me, some of my coworkers would say, you need to notch that down and not be so vocal. I say, be vocal and embrace what you have. And I would always tell my supervisors, I know myself better than you know me. And I know my skills and what my worth is. Mm-hmm. And most of the time mm-hmm. it would be a positive communication. But millennials just need to embrace who they are and forget that all the hardship, the criticism, make all that, turn it into something of work for you yeah. to make yourself work harder and to do what you got to do, because nobody can define you.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the ballet dancer? I went to see her. The young
Oh, Misty Copeland.
Yeah. I remember Misty Copeland, like they think, just like Michael Jordan, they didn't think they could be great at what they did.
Mm-hmm.
No one can tell you what your greatness is.
Yeah.
You use your gifts and your talents as you know where you're being led.
And trust in that.
And trust in that. Yeah. And trust in your ability. That's one thing I think that helped me all those years. I trusted my ability. I didn't care what nobody else
yeah.
said.
Yeah. And I think even and in that trust, you find your lane and you stay in it. Mm-hmm. Whereas I'm someone who tends to be, I have a big mouth, so I'm going to mm-hmm. be more vocal. I'm going to call people out. But not mm-hmm. everybody's made to do that. Right. And so if you're made to fight the fight in a different right. way, then lean into whatever that right. is and fight that fight, because right. we need your voice.
Right. And the other thing I think that people have to compliment with, look, I was very forceful. I'm talkative and I already got it out there. But people could always say, but you know what? She's so nice. She does something crazy for me. Like, why is she like that? Because I want to show kindness as I'm telling you this, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to be not nice to you.
Right.
Disrespect
you. You're still going to tell
I'm
it like it
telling
is.
You the truth is the truth.
Exactly.
I'm just telling you what the truth is. And then we can go have a cup of coffee.
But you know people are afraid of the truth, especially because, yes. you know, a lot of my experience is in the evangelical right. world, and right. they don't like the truth.
Right, because they don't, well, because it's not the truth for them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
not the truth. So, quite frankly, I don't expect them to know the truth.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't expect somebody to know, like out little dog Jimmy, we don't expect him to know what our conversation is about. Yeah, and we just go with the flow and, you know.
Yeah.
I don't expect white people to understand, to know my pain, and know what I'm feeling about stuff. I don't expect them to know that.
Yeah.
And so when they say something crazy, I'm just like, yeah, well,
that's for the course. About, yeah, it's par for the course.
Yeah, par for the course.
That's, and that's why yeah. I say we have got to lift up and empower one another as a community. Yeah. And I think that goes for any minority group. If you're Native American, if you are Hispanic, mm-hmm. if you are an LGBTQ+ community, mm-hmm. lift up and empower your community.
Mm-hmm.
Don't put all the effort and all the work onto advocates and allies, because they have a lot to
That's
learn.
That's what Martin Luther King did.
Yeah, you got a lot to learn in order to get, right. for them, they have a lot to learn in order for them to even right. be able to make a difference.
Right.
And so, yeah, love and respect.
Yeah, that's why the civil rights movement was so powerful, because Black people were empowering themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think we're slowly seeing it. Like, I the amount of young Black entrepreneurs that I've come in, like, gotten to rub elbows with in the last few years, and I love watching them, even though, like, it's a struggle to be an entrepreneur and to start mm-hmm. your own business and do all that. It takes a minute until you actually see financial gain. Mm-hmm. But I think in the long run,
right.
like the amount of what's the word? Like power and respect and love mm-hmm. that puts back into our community. Right, I'm right. like, go for it.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. Most definitely.
Well, is there anything else you'd like the Okay Let's Talk listeners to know before you go?
No, I just enjoyed the conversation, and I appreciate being asked to be a guest. And this is my first time doing this, so I'm not sure how all this will turn out.
Yay! But you, like, honestly, y'all, this is how conversations in our house always sound. We always talk about stuff like this. So I was like, Mom, you should just come on the show.
That's right. And well, maybe thanks. I'll be on again sometime next year.
She definitely will be on again. All right, you guys, you know how I always sign off, but make sure you are loving yourself well and loving your community well today. And also reach out and empower someone. All right. And until next time, this is Okay, Let's Talk, and I'm Kendall. Bye. Thanks for tuning into this episode of Okay, Let's Talk. Be sure to hit that subscribe button to stay up to date on our latest episodes. You can also check the episode notes for ways to get in touch with me and for more info on the show. Until next time, own your story and live empowered. Bye.